I talked to this hotel guy and I said, you know, I'd like to go up and do some photography, take pictures of wild animals and stuff. He goes, well, let me see if I can find somebody for you. So he found a guy and he just happened to be the province chief's son, which really helped out a lot. He wasn't no wimp or anything. I went and got a bunch of maps. I put them all together for the whole thing where this jet crash was and from Ban Lung. And yeah, he says, it's about a 10-day hike up there. I told him, I said, what I want to do is I want to go up here. I said, there's a jet crash up here. And he goes, I know the site. I know the crash site. It took us 10 days. We first went by a truck to a place where they had elephants. Then we took elephants up. And when we were in Tavang, they had boats that went up the river. So then we went up the river in these dugout boats. Then we had to walk through. We stopped at villages. We stopped at about 5 villages, you know, at night. And that was about it. It took us 10 days to get up there, going up rivers through the bushes and everything, and it took forever. But we got up in there and we stayed there for 3 days. And on the third day, we got held up by bandits. Thank goodness I had the province chief's son. So they just screamed and yelled at us and everything and said, get out of here.
Welcome to Heroes Behind Headlines. I'm your host, Ralph Pizzullo. Today, we bring you part two of my interview with Jim H. Shorten Jones, a.k.a. Wild Carrot, one of the heroes of the secret war in Vietnam. In this episode, Jim is going to talk about the Bright Light mission he went on as a 1-0 or team leader of Recon Team Delaware to find, identify, and recover two Air Force pilots from a downed F-4D Phantom jet, codenamed Cobra 84, that crashed in northern Cambodia, and how he returned more than 30 years later to try to recover the pilot's remains. Additionally, Jim is going to tell us about his time with Air Force Pararescue, including two very perilous rescues at sea that he participated in, and serving as a parachuting paramedic for the first three launches of the space shuttle. It's my great honor to welcome back the amazing Jim Shorten Jones as today's hero behind the headlines.
Heroes Behind Headlines with Ralph Pizzullo.
Then I had the Cobra 84 mission. That's the big one.
Yeah.
Where a jet went down. He was dropping a bomb on a bridge over in Cambodia. And when he dropped the bomb, the bomb was long, and he hit the first. Well, what happened is he took a 51 caliber and he lost his hydraulics. He hit the first hill, went through the second hill and landed on the third hill. And he hit the first hill so hard that the engines left the aircraft.
Wow.
There's two jet engines. They just left the aircraft and flew. They landed not too far from where the jet was.
Uh-huh.
But
and that was an F-4?
That was an F-4.
Okay.
It was a Cobra 84.
That's a pilot and a co-pilot, or?
Actually, there's two pilots in it.
Oh, okay.
They had a pilot, and then they have the engineer in the back.
Okay.
But the, you know, that they were both pilots.
Right.
And they were running the mission together.
Right. So you went in to recover those guys?
Yeah, they asked me to go on in, so I took my team, NRT Delaware, and I was on the first chopper. Homer was on the second chopper, Homer Hungerford. And so I went ahead and I got in there, and I'm waiting for the second chopper to come in, and it's all burned out on the first, where the first hill where it hit.
Mm-hmm.
So I landed there, and there's ash flying around. It was a short ladder. You know, the ladders are, I don't even know how long those ladders are. I think 30 feet, 35 feet.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but the short ladder is when the chopper can't get down to the ground, but they drop a short ladder, and that ladder is, it might be 10 feet off the ground.
Okay.
So you just go ahead and climb down. The rest of it just lays on the ground. So I climbed down that, and then they took off, and the next chopper comes in, and I'm waiting, you know, Homer and them get, but when I'm coming down the ladder, the bamboo that was there was whipping around. It hit me in the butt end.
Wow.
Ripped all my butt out of my pants.
Wow.
So, and I didn't wear underwear. Yeah. So I got this bare butt, you know, walking through there.
Yeah.
And and my bandana to cover my, I had bright red hair.
Yeah.
My bandana covered over my hair. So I flipped over my face. I couldn't even see where I was going. I just did it by feel.
Yeah.
Till I got to the ground.
Wow.
And so then when that chopper left, then Homer came in. And when he got there, we sat there and waited for a while, waiting for our ears to clear.
Yeah.
Because you're coming down from altitude.
Yeah.
And then I'm waiting for all the sticks to stop dropping. And so then we started moseying on down the path where the jet went through. So I get down the first saddle. I look off to the side, to my right side, and I see three enemy.
Yeah.
And one of them had a weapon on me. The others might have had weapons. I don't know. I couldn't see.
Yeah.
They were behind bushes. But the one guy had a weapon on me, and I told my guys, Komsong, you know, like that, don't shoot.
Yeah.
And I said it in Vietnamese, so because they understood what it means, because they knew those kind of terminology, even though they're Montagnard.
Yeah.
And the Vietnamese could hear me.
Yeah.
So I told the enemy, I just went like that with my rifle. And so they just took off and left.
Wow.
Yeah, because I wasn't there to get into a firefight and let everybody know where I was.
Yeah.
I just wanted to get the pilots out.
Right, right.
So I walked down, and as I get down into the bottom.
So they just let you pass through, no problem.
Yeah, I just wanted to get the pilots out. That was my mission. Yeah. That wasn't to get into battle.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I get down to the middle. And once I get there, I start seeing all these bunkers.
Mm.
And I walked over to one bunker. I see CBU sitting in the bunker that didn't go off.
A CBU is a cluster bomb, fuel air explosive, that was developed by the U.S. Air Force during the Vietnam War. According to the British-based Mines Advisory Group, of the 260 million cluster bomblets that rained down on Laos and Cambodia, between 1964 and 1973, 80 million failed to explode.
So then I started going a little bit further, and I look over, and I see this communist star sitting over a graveyard.
Yeah.
And I go in the graveyard. I couldn't read the names. It was like somebody wrote on the rocks with a pencil or something. It was really bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
And I counted about, I don't know, six or seven graves. And then when I came out, I saw this big meeting room. It was like 20 by 20 feet made out of bamboo, mm-hmm, on stilts off the ground.
Wow.
And so then we started going up the hill, and I found a boot with a foot in it. It was an American boot, but it turned out to be an enemy foot.
Oh.
Yeah. And so got that. We threw that in the rucksack, and then we started picking up little pieces of the jet.
Yeah.
So they could determine what part of the jet it came from, and they'd know if the jet fell apart and stuff.
Yeah.
So we did that. I got up to the top. I saw a bomb sitting there. And then I started seeing these floor patterns in the dirt.
Hmm.
And whether it was hooches, but when the jet went through, it wiped out those hooches.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And that's probably where like that foot came from.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And then the whole village, except for when the path was where the jet went through, the village was all woven over with bamboo.
Hmm.
You know, they just tied the trees together in the bamboo. The Ho Chi Minh Trail was the same way, by the way.
Yeah.
When I came over, I looked down, I saw the bridge, and I'm going, oh, shit. You know, because then I knew I was on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and I'm going, this isn't going to be good.
Yeah.
But they had the trees woven over at the top of the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
It was completely covered. You couldn't see it from the air.
Yeah, except for where the bridge was.
Yeah.
So then, anyway, I saw this bomb sitting there, I guess a 500-pound bomb or 750. I think it was a 750-pound bomb. I thought it was probably from the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and somebody brought it up, and they were, because they'll dissect the bombs and take the composition B out of them.
Yeah.
And make satchel charges.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so that's what I thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it, you know, the more I think about it, it probably came from the jet.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think the B-52s that drop all those bombs on the Ho Chi Minh, I think they're 500-pounders.
Yeah.
You know, or 100-pounders. I don't remember. I think they're 500-pounders. I know I couldn't.
But I think you're right, 500.
Yeah, 500-pound. I think they drop 108 bombs apiece.
Yeah.
I had Homer. I told Homer, when I was coming up the road, coming up the hill, before I got to that flat area where I saw the squares,
yeah,
as I was coming up, I could hear trucks coming down the road.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I can hear them. I can hear the movement on the road. And so FAC overhead said, you got six truckloads of enemy and armored cars coming, and a bunch of troops running behind them coming after you.
Yeah.
And so I get up there. I told Homer, I said, hey, Homer, take a group, run over this way. I'll go over this way. We'll run through and for the hooches.
Yeah.
And we're trying to pick up as much stuff as we could from the hooches.
Yeah.
And we found pith helmets and officers' belt buckles, all kinds of medicinal bottles, bandages, and all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we stuffed them in the rucksack. And by that time, they said, we got to get you out of there.
Yeah.
Because they're firing miniguns. They're shooting everything. The miniguns, they fired right over my head before I got to that top.
Wow.
And I couldn't figure what the heck was going on. All you hear is the crack over the top of your head.
Yeah.
You know, and then once you hear that crack, then you can hear the where it's coming from. The bzzz, you know, where they're firing it from.
Yeah. Wow.
But yeah, that was really close. I mean, I was sweaty and everything because it's, you know, it's over 100 degrees and you're in that smoggy, you know, that moisture in that air.
Yeah.
So all the stuff, branches, everything were coming down from the miniguns and just landing on me and sticking to me. And so then they said, we got to get you out of there. So that's when we ran real quick, got as much stuff as we could throw out in there. I could see the jet on the third hill, but I said, I haven't been over, I can't get over there.
Yeah.
He says, well, we're going to have to get you out of there.
Yeah.
So that'll leave you there.
Yeah.
And I didn't, and I figured it wouldn't be a matter of time. They'd have 1,000, 2,000 enemy on top of me.
Sure, sure.
You know, they estimated 350 enemy as it was.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I couldn't figure out why it took so long for them to come up the hill after me. It took them a while, like 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so that first chopper came in and got Homer and two of the guys out. And then the next chopper comes in. I said, is that right? That's 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Yeah, he took two guys with him, and I took three guys. I had three stay with me, so there'd be four of us on the ground. And so as soon as, and they're still shooting at these guys.
Yeah.
And so as soon as the second chopper was on, it's coming in, these guys started coming through the bushes at us.
Wow.
And so we're firing them. One of them got an RPG off, and I got hit in the arm. And I got hit in the chest, and I still got some shrapnel in here. Well, the shrapnel's over here.
Yeah.
I got hit here and went across and landed there.
Wow.
From the RPG.
Yeah.
And I didn't think much of it. You know, I didn't even know I got hit. I thought I cut myself on bushes.
Wow.
But
the adrenaline was so strong, you just didn't even.
Oh, yeah. You don't even think about it. I mean, you can take out your bullet and you're just going to keep moving. I mean, your adrenaline's so high.
Wow. Wow.
So, but we're firing at the enemy, and then the chopper was coming in. And I said, I want Cobra gunships on both sides of that chopper shooting behind us and in front of us.
Yeah.
Keep these guys down. So the gunships coming, I mean, the Huey's coming in. And as he's coming in, he's dropping ladders, and the gunners are shooting like crazy on the choppers.
Yeah.
They're shooting like crazy to try to keep these guys down. And so we run over and we get on the ladder. The guy's hooked in, and I start climbing up the ladder, but I hear this bam, bam, really loud.
Yeah.
And I thought the chopper took an RPG, and I was waiting for it to come down on top of us.
Mm-hmm.
And, but what it was is, he hit a tree.
Oh.
And he took out almost 2 feet of his rotor on both ends.
Wow.
Yeah, and but he still managed to get us out of there.
Wow.
The chopper took a bunch of hits. We all got kind of messed up from that RPG thing.
Yeah.
But we got out of there. Nobody was hurt serious, but we couldn't get to that jet. And as I got up, I could see that jet sitting over there, and it always kind of bugged. That's the only mission I ever failed on.
Yeah.
But I mean, that was a lot of enemy.
Yeah, yeah. There's no way you were going to get there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if I would have stayed there, chances are, you know, Homer probably wouldn't have made it because of his age. And then they would have just killed the Montagnards and stuff.
Yeah.
And I was thinking I'd just let them go. And in retrospect, let them all go and I'll stay here. And I'll go check out the pilots tomorrow. You know, bury myself in the leaves or something and hide.
Right, right.
You know, I've done that before in training. When I was going through Special Forces.
Yeah.
Guys walked all around me, didn't see me. I just buried myself in leaves. So that worked pretty good.
Wow.
So we came out of there, and I went back, and I had to talk to the Cobra A3 guys, told them there was no way anybody could live through that.
Yeah.
And but I couldn't see if there was any pilots there. I couldn't tell if there was like a helmet sitting inside the jet.
Was it pretty much intact?
The fuselage was pretty much intact, except the wings were gone and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Could you see the cockpit, or was it?
Yeah, you could see the cockpit. I couldn't see it. I couldn't see what was in it.
Yeah.
I mean, it was 100 yards away.
Right, 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 right.
You know, but I could see the jet sitting there, but I couldn't see anything. And when I was coming up and I looked over at it, I still couldn't tell if there was anybody laying there on the ground.
Yeah.
Because they're wearing gray suits. They don't wear the orange ones like the Navy does.
Right.
They were wearing gray suits, and so I couldn't. They would blend in.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
So, but it was really kind of tragic.
Yeah.
I've been in. I'm friends with the family.
Yeah.
The pilots and stuff. It was Eric Hubert and Alan Trent.
Uh huh.
Uh-huh. Were the two pilots.
Uh-huh.
And I went back again in. I went back in 2002. I had a buddy that I was on an A-team with. He lived in Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in Washington at the time, Washington State. And we started picking up each other, talking on internet.
Yeah.
And I told him, I said, how you doing? I said, it's been a while. And I said, we were talking. I said, I always wanted to go back and see if I can find that jet.
Yeah.
And he goes, well, let's go do it. So he came down to my house and we worked it out a little bit and talked and stuff. And I told him, I said, here, I got to, because I'm a radiologist, a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to take time off of work. And they weren't really pleased with that.
Yeah.
Because I was doing over a couple of hundred cases a day. You know? So that means they're going to take off the load.
Yeah.
So, but I told him, I said, look, I got to take a few months off.
Yeah.
And so I gave, what was his name? I can't think of his name. Anyway, Harlow Short was his name.
Mm-hmm.
So Harlow came down to my house. I gave him $15,000 or $16,000. I said, hey, you go over there and start setting things up and I'll follow back.
Mm-hmm.
I'll follow up. So we went over there and we started talking back and forth. And he goes, yeah, I think I got everything together. Why don't you come on over? So I talked to joint recovery teams in, now it's DPAA, Defense WMIA Accounting Agency.
Yeah.
I talked with them and one of the guys sent me a whole box full of all the information they had.
Yeah.
And he sent me maps where they found stuff and everything else. So I went ahead and got the time off and I grabbed, another like 20 grand or whatever. And I just went on over.
Yeah.
And I met Harlow in Phnom Penh, Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
I met with the joint recovery teams there, talked to them. And they said they probably didn't have enough information to go back in there.
Yeah.
When they told me they were going to go back in. So one of the guys on their team was a former Special Forces. And he told me, he goes, look, he said, if you want to go, just go.
Yeah.
I go, like, how? He goes, go up to Ban Lung. He goes, so fly up to Ban Lung and just put a team together and just go.
Yeah.
I said, okay. So I flew up to Ban Lung, which is right south of the tri-border.
Mm-hmm. And that's in Cambodia?
That's in Cambodia.
Yeah.
And it's a Ratakan Kari province.
Mm-hmm.
So I talked to this hotel guy and I said, I'd like to go up and do some photography, take pictures of wild animals and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, well, let me see if I can find somebody for you. So he found a guy and he just happened to be the province chief's son, which really helped out a lot.
Sure, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we were talking and stuff and I realized he was a pretty cool guy.
Yeah.
He wasn't no wimp or anything.
Yeah.
And so I went and got a bunch of maps. I put them all together for the whole thing where this jet crash was and from Ban Lung. And and he goes, he says, it's about a 10-day hike up there.
Yeah.
And I go, okay. So we put everything together. And then I told him, I said, what I want to do is I want to go up here. I said, there's a jet crash up here. And he goes, he says, I know the site. I know the crash site.
No kidding.
I go, really? He goes, yeah. He goes, yeah, we can do that. He says, let me get some men. So he got five other guys. So the six of us and those guys, it was six of those guys and myself. And Harlow's son was a young guy. And he spoke Thai, which is, I guess, pretty close to Laotian.
Mm-hmm.
And so he came along with us, too.
Hmm.
So we went all the way up there. It took us 10 days.
Wow.
We first went by a truck to a place where they had elephants. Then we took elephants up, and then we got to a place.
You were riding elephants?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, then we got to a place in Tavang. And when we were in Tavang, they had boats that went up the river.
Uh-huh.
So then we went up the river in these dugout boats, and they had these little motors on them.
Yeah.
So we went up the river on those, and then we got off to the side. Then we had to walk through. We stopped at villages. We stopped at about five villages, at night.
Yeah.
Get up in the morning, and they'd have all the food ready for us. We were living off the land.
Yeah, yeah.
Eating what they found.
Yeah, because you'd have to carry everything.
Yeah. We carried rice. We definitely had to carry rice.
Right.
I carried a lot of noodles, those little packs of Chinese noodles, you know?
Yeah.
I carried a bunch of those, but I ran out real quick, you know? And I'd share them with the other guys. They'd mix it with the rice, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But we, you know, they'd get fish. They'd butterfly the fish and open them up and just let them dry out and it'd be like jerky.
Yeah.
I remember one time I got up from the village. I got out of my hammock and I'm going, oh, that smells really good.
Yeah.
I went over there and this guy's stirring these. He had like 20 frogs in this pot. And he's stirring the pots and smashing them up and making. And I'm going, oh, man, that smells good, but I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Does it taste good?
Yeah. So I had my rice and the juice was really good.
Yeah.
And I took some pieces of meat and stuff. You know, they eat the bones, the skin, the eyeballs, guts, everything.
Wow.
I just wanted a little piece of meat, you know, put it in there.
Yeah. Wow.
So,
what an adventure.
And then for water, they have this plant up there that grows,
mm-hmm.
and it's a root that they put in the water,
mm-hmm.
and they boil it, and they let it get cold, and in the water tastes really good. It's almost, I guess, kind of like a very weak, watered-down root beer.
Okay.
But it tastes really good. So we had that.
Uh-huh.
And that was about it. It took us 10 days to get up there,
wow.
going up rivers,
yeah.
through the bushes and everything, and it took forever. But we got up in there, and we stayed there for 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
And on the third day, we got held up by bandits.
Jeez.
And thank goodness I had the province chief's son.
Yeah, yeah.
They didn't want to have any problems. So they just screamed and yelled at us and everything and said, get out of here. We don't want you here tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know, and they were coming down from Laos, too, some of the they were bandits.
Mm-hmm.
And they were some of them were police and some of them were army, you know, because they just don't get paid.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, the government just doesn't pay them.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they pay them when they feel like it.
Yeah.
So anyway, they held us up with AKs and everything. And so the next day, we were going to leave anyway the next day. And it took us 10 days to get on back. And I didn't really find much. I brought back pieces of the jet and gave it to the family.
Mm-hmm.
But so we got back. I had a big party with the guys and thanked them and everything and paid them. I think I gave them like $600 total.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I went up to Laos, ran into DPAA at or the Joint Recovery Teams. I ran into them at Atapu, Laos.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw them and I went over and I said, hi, you remember me? And he goes, oh, yeah. What are you doing here? I says, well, I went up to that crash site.
Yeah.
He goes, how'd you get there? I said, I walked.
Yeah.
He goes, what? I gave him a bunch of pictures,
yeah.
and you know, everything I took and everything and everything I found. And then in 2017, DPAA called me up and said, we're going to that crash site. Would you like to go? And I said, yeah, I'd love to go. And so I went back in 2017 with them and I worked with them.
Mm-hmm.
I was only supposed to be there, was going to be there for 6 weeks, but they were only going to keep me there for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But the guys liked me so much that, you know, because I helped them work. I didn't sit around drinking and telling war stories. I got up in the morning and worked with them, you know, time to get to work, you know, and I walked down. I would leave when they're getting ready. They have a little talk at the end before they come back up to the top of the hill.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd leave early so I could get, because those guys are young little whippersnappers.
Yeah, yeah.
There was this one girl, she could run up that hill.
No kidding.
You know, wow, me, but they can do in like 5-10 minutes. It took me like 20.
Yeah, 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 sure, sure.
Because I was like 60 years old or 65 or something. I don't know, I was old.
Yeah.
So I did that and I found some bullets from one of the pilots, you know, 38. They carried 38s in a vest.
Mm-hmm.
I found that. We found a lot of parts of the vest. We found lots of parts of the aircraft, wires and junk like that. And then I was supposed to go back again, but they didn't take me. And then on that time, they found Alan Trent's dog tags.
Okay.
But one of the problems there in that area is the mineralization in the soil is so strong that it demineralizes the bones and destroys the bones.
Oh, wow.
But on that time that I went back with them, a guy from Stony Beach, a guy named Eric, he went down and talked to the Vietnamese,
mm-hmm.
and I drew him a map. I said, tell him to check in this area here. This is where the battle was.
Yeah.
And he gave him the map, and they go, where'd you get this map? He goes, well, the guy that your guys were trying to kill is up there looking for the two pilots. And he goes, He goes, he drew this map to show you where the battle was.
Yeah.
He goes, yeah. He says, we found 126 bodies so far, but we're still missing over 100.
Wow.
So that's how many were killed. And we don't know how many died afterwards.
Wow.
So they had over 226 people killed in that battle.
Wow.
When all they had to do is just let me go get those two pilots and get them out of there.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, which is really tragic. Yeah. I think that's really a stupid part on the enemies.
Those were mostly killed by the A1s and so on. The
aircraft. Yeah, they were killed, but you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think, I don't know how many we might have shot up.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And how many fell.
But they could have just let you go in and recover the bodies and leave.
Yeah,
and nobody
that's the thing to do.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like they did during the First World War, you know, the pilots and stuff.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
You know, but they, yeah, it's stupid on their part. They're hurt. They're losing people left and right. And here they just let them get killed.
Right.
Crazy. You know, like when Lynn Black went in, he got hit with over 10,000 enemy.
Wow.
You know, and they had something like, what, 90% killed that day? 90% killed or wounded or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
And he got to talk to one of the officers who, when he talked to him, it turned out to be a general. But he talked to one of those guys, and he goes, no, it was a regiment. It was a huge group of people.
Wow.
And he asked, he says, who was the guy that kept standing up and shooting? And he goes, I was standing up without shooting. I said, I shot this guy three times. He wouldn't go stay down. He kept getting up. He goes, that was me. The guy that was now a general in the North Vietnamese Army. The guy kept getting
up. The
other
guy who shot me.
You shot him three times.
Oh, my God.
So, but he lived.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Some crazy stories.
Yeah.
SOG was really a very dangerous mission.
Yeah.
And that's why the guys that are left were so close.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. They're really close.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
So that was that mission. And I'm hoping to go back again this next year with the guys. I don't know if it'll happen or not, but I'll see what happens.
Yeah.
And they got civilian companies now going in,
mm-hmm.
but the civilian company can't take me in unless the government says okay.
Yeah.
So I told them, I said, I'll pay my way.
Yeah.
Just let me know. I can fly to Hawaii and then you guys can take me from there. You know, I'll go with their C-17 or whatever they're going to fly over.
Yeah.
So I can fly on military aircraft. I got an ID card and everything, so I can fly on military aircraft.
Since 1973, the remains of more than 1,000 Americans killed during the Vietnam War have been identified and returned to their families for burial with full military honors. Of the nearly 1,600 Americans still unaccounted for from the Vietnam War, hundreds are believed to be in a, quote, non-recoverable category, meaning that after vigorous investigation, the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency, DPAA, has determined that the individual perished, but does not believe it is possible to recover the remains. On rare occasions, new leads can bring a case back to active status.
So anyway, so from there, when I came back, they asked me if I wanted to go teach down at B-53.
Mm-hmm.
So I went down to B-53 and I taught infill, exfil, and all that stuff.
And where's B-53?
That was north of Benoit, which is, I guess, just north of Saigon. We're about, I think, an hour and 15 minutes from Saigon.
And it was a training camp?
Yeah, it was a training camp for special ops. And they had the Op 36 guys there and all that stuff. But I taught infill, exfil, and Frank Norberry was there. He put me through. He let me do the free fall jumps with him there. So I got three of those jumps there. I had 19 jumps in Vietnam. Three of them were free fall.
Mm-hmm.
I had two or three jumps at Dong Ba Tin, and the rest were down at Long Tan.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd be a stick kicker or a wind dummy for the Vietnamese jumping.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd go out with the teams. We train them. I train them in different aspects of recon. And then they'd have a couple of lane graders that go out. They have the team go out. They work together. And then we'd lane grade them. We wouldn't tell them anything. Sometimes we would.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we see them making a mistake, we'll correct it. So we did that.
Mm-hmm.
I went out with John Caviani, you know, Medal of Honor recipient.
Yeah.
I went out when he came down, I went out with him. And him and I came out, there was four strings coming out. There was like, I think it's four, five, eight. There was nine of us on the ground. And so John, what happened is that the chopper came in, dropped four ropes, and they came out on strings, those four guys. So there's five of us left on the ground. So the next chopper came in, dropped four ropes. And so John and I hooked up to one rope.
Mm-hmm.
And we're hanging at an angle, you know. So we're hanging below everybody else. And so we're coming up out of there. We got compromised by the enemy, and they were resect, you know, doing a radio intersection, crossing us, trying to find out where we were. And they were talking like they were in helicopters, you know, like, oh, okay, this is so-and-so, you know. And they were talking to us, and we knew who it was. We knew it was the enemy.
Right.
So anyway, the choppers came over, and they said, keep talking to them, keep talking to them. And they come around, and they resected them, or, you know, found out where they were.
Yeah.
Intersected those guys.
Oh, wow.
And so then they had gunships going in and taking those guys out.
Wow.
And so then we came out on the ropes, and John and I are hanging down, and we're shooting down at the enemy, you know, like, you know, where we thought they were.
Right.
I don't know what John saw, but he's shooting like crazy. And we're spinning in circles.
Jeez.
And he's just yelling Yahoo and stuff. And I'm John, in the other direction, you know, stop us from spinning. So I got my gun and started shooting the other direction to try and slow us down.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, Johnny was a cool guy. I like Johnny. Mm-hmm. Then we did that. And then I had a mission where I taught POW snatch, taking prisoner snatch missions.
Mm-hmm.
I taught that. And then RT Mamba came down from CCN, and I ran out with them. I trained those guys with a couple of other guys trained. So I ran out with those guys, and there was another team from CCC, and another guy went out with them.
Uh-huh.
So we're out there, and the guy from CCC had a siren. And he's cranking, because when you want to take a prisoner, you want the enemy to know where you are.
Ah.
And so they can come in. I don't know if that's a wise decision in Laos to Cambodia, because they're going to come after you with a heavy
everything. Button. Yeah.
But in Vietnam, you can take guys pretty easy.
Okay.
So they're cranking the siren and stuff. We could hear it at night, and they didn't get anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But the next morning, we heard this oxen walking up this trail.
Yeah.
Because they had this little bell on them.
Yeah.
They're walking up this trail, and we jumped out and stopped them and found out that they had a bunch of implements to make mines in the underneath the wood.
Oh.
And they had three NVA. They had a woman making it look like a wife.
Yeah.
And they had two other guys, and they had some kids with them to make it look like a family.
Yeah.
You know, and what happened is this was in the Australians area of operation, and they had a mission. We were going out, and they got ambushed, and they ran into a field, and a 36 of them got killed or injured.
Wow.
They ran into a minefield.
Yeah.
So they knew they were making mines up there, and we wanted to find out where.
Yeah.
We took them in. We got them in. We sent the kids off, said just we destroyed everything they had, and then said, take your cattle, take the kids, and just go back home.
Yeah.
And there was some choppers flying overhead. They wanted to shoot them up.
Wow.
And I told them, I said, you shoot them up, I'm going to make you come down here and look at it.
Yeah.
And so the CNC ship, not command and control like what we were,
yeah,
but it's a command and control for Vietnam. There was a CNC ship flying overhead, and he came up and he goes, what's going on? And I said, these guys want to shoot up these ox carts down here. And I said, they're nothing but kids. We're sending them home.
Yeah.
And so the CNC ship told the choppers to get out of there.
Yeah.
And then the kids just went on home.
Yeah.
But they were like 5, 6, 10 years old, 12 years old, you know, just little kids.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, we took those three prisoners back in the chopper, and we interrogated them. Then we sent them to the Australians, and they interrogate them. Nothing harsh. No, they don't do waterboarding and stuff.
Yeah.
But they just talk to them, and then they turn them over to the district chief, and then the district chief will say something like, we'll let you go if you don't hit our village.
Yeah.
And so then they just go, that's the politics in Vietnam. You know, so you can't blame them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Fighting for 100 years, you know.
Right, right. You know. Yeah, yeah, wow.
So anything else in Special Forces? I would say when I came back to the States, I was underwater operations.
Yeah.
And they sent our whole team down for scuba school. And we all passed on that. We did all good. I think they might have been a little lenient in some places because they didn't want the team to get separated.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we all made it. And it wasn't easy. I mean, the diving school is really tough.
Yeah.
So, but they make it rough on you.
Yeah.
So did that. And then, but there was nothing going on. We went to Panama, trained Panamanian guerrillas, survival.
Yeah.
Which I thought was kind of ridiculous. They lived there.
Yeah.
But when I got there, I realized that these were all city kids and they knew nothing about the jungle.
Ah.
So we trained them. And then we came on back. I remember when I was down there, we had to get a resupply out in the jungle. And there was this old rifle range out there. And it was the only area that was, it had a lot, it was old. So it had a lot of scrub brush growing in there.
Mm-hmm.
But the trees weren't there.
Yeah.
And so we gave them the coordinates and they were going to drop a resupply there. But we had a really nasty lightning thunderstorm that night.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were behind the berm, underneath this berm, because it was protected us from getting all wet.
Yeah.
And there's these big metal targets there. And it was a guy named Buck Ravenscroft and myself. So Bucky and I are underneath this thing, and the Panamanians stayed down on another, away from us, because they were just all speaking Spanish and talking to each other.
Yeah.
And man, this lightning was coming down and striking these targets. And I'm going, damn. You know, you can see it, the lightning running along the ground and everything was striking.
Wow.
And I got up and I'm looking down at the Panamanians waiting for another lightning flash so I could see them. And they're standing up just looking down at us. And I guess, well, they're just standing here like it's like an everyday occurrence. So I guess it's not nothing to worry about.
Yeah.
So the next morning I get up and I go down. I says, is it always lightning like that? And he goes, no, we were scared to death. We looked down, saw you standing there. So I guess we figured everything was okay. So, but it was pretty,
wow.
It was pretty funny.
That's crazy. So,
but then we came back and then I was training Air Force, pararescue guys. And I had no clue what pararescue was.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even because we used them, you know, they were the Jolly Greens in Vietnam.
Yeah.
The Jollies and the Super Jollies. And they were the guys that flew the Sante raid guys and stuff like this. They were a good bunch of guys.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting there talking to him. And I said, what do you guys do anyway? He goes, we do rescues. We rescue plane crashes, you know, astronauts. We go out in the ocean. We parachute in, take care of these guys. And I'm going, really? These guys do that? He goes, yeah, we do it on a weekly basis.
Yeah.
I'm going, really? So on my day off, I went down to the group called the 129th Aerospace Rescue Recovery Service. So, and they were pararescue. So I went down, I talked to them, and their team sergeant leader they had there was a former Special Forces guy. He is a reserve Special Forces guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm talking to him and he goes, let me show you a letter. He shows me this letter where pararescue needs more combat training,
mm-hmm.
you know, and which is kind of leading up to where pararescue is today.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, I'm getting so tired of combat.
Yeah.
So, you know, I got 3.5 years of it.
Yeah.
So he goes, well, that's your ticket in right there.
Yeah.
I'm going, well, okay. So they tested me to make sure I could pass everything. And
mm-hmm.
and I did all the push-ups, John, running. I had to run. I had to swim 1,000 yards or whatever the heck it was. And so I passed that and they sent me to school. I didn't have to go to jump school. I didn't have to go to Halo and I didn't have to go to, what's the other one? Scuba school.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't have to go to Lackland. And a lot of the PJs hate me because of that. I didn't have to go to Lackland, Man U. That's where they lose a lot of guys.
Yeah, yeah. So,
but I love water harassment and stuff like that. I love being tested like that.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was at, I went to Kirkland and I did all the medical training and then rough terrain parachute school, which I already went to one in Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
So I went through their rough terrain parachuting. And then I had to go through all the scuba parachute training with full scuba gear.
Wow.
And then the mountain climbing.
So you jump with full scuba gear.
Oh yeah. You jump with full scuba gear.
Wow.
Yeah. I said, you know, if you could go on my Facebook page, you can go in there and take all those pictures. There's pictures of me in full scuba gear.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Because you're carrying a main chute, 2 scuba tanks to keep the parachute level.
Yeah.
And then you got your wetsuit on, then you've got a repelling rig. There's a pad in there. They put a pad mm-hmm. in between there And that's so the tanks don't hit you in the back and hurt you.
Yeah.
But the parachute goes on the back outside of the tanks, obviously. And then you've got a reserve. You got all your medical gear underneath that. You've got a raft underneath the tanks.
Oh, my God.
You got your water wings on, which I hate. And then you got all your other gear.
Yeah.
You know, your flippers, mask, and knives and all that junk.
Wow. And you jump with all of that.
Oh, yeah. You jump with all the gear. You got over 100 pounds of equipment on you.
Wow.
That's why in pararescue, you got to be really, really strong.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Really strong.
Sure, sure. And so the idea is that you hit the water and then you can, you're totally operational. You can get to work right away.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. When you hit the water, like in a real mission, you just dump the parachute. The parachute just sinks.
Yeah.
You know, because I had a couple of missions way out in the middle of the ocean. If you want me to talk about some of those, I can.
Sure. Yeah, please.
Yeah. So I did a quite a few hoist missions where you just go out and you get down on the boat, you know, on a hoist. One of the things you do on a ship, even if it's a metal ship, when that hoist is coming down, you want to get away from it.
Yeah.
You jump off that hoist to get onto the ship.
Yeah.
Because it'll arc.
Mm.
The chopper flying like a few hundred miles.
Yeah.
It'll the rotor picks up a lot of static electricity.
Ah.
And so if you're sitting on that they call it a jungle penetrator, it has little paddles that come out. And you sit on it. And so when you're coming down, it'll arc between the deck of the ship to your foot. And if you got feelings, you're going to know it.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Your eyeballs will pop out of your head.
There's that much electricity.
Oh, it's a lot. If you ever see helicopters, like you see it in the movies sometimes where helicopters are flying at night.
Yeah.
And if they bank a little bit, you can see the flame on. You can see the, I guess it's like St. Elmo's fire or something. And you'll see it on the rotor.
Yeah.
You know.
Wow, wow.
Picks up all that static electricity. Wow,
so you got to get off that hoist before you hit the deck, otherwise you're...
Oh, yeah, you want to get off it.
Yeah.
And I had one time where just as I was getting off of it, the ship came up because it was in the water.
Yeah.
It came up and got closer and it arced.
Wow.
It got me, hit my foot, went through my fillings, and I'm going, yikes.
Wow.
So then, but once it's done, it's done.
Yeah.
So then you just get off there and then... then the next guy will come down or whatever. They come down together, however we want to do it.
Yeah.
And then you get the guy that's injured. You put him in it. You fix him up. Make sure he's, if he's a bleeder or something, you take care of him. Put him in a litter. And then they take the penetrator off. They put a Stokes litter on it. Bring it down. You get him in there. Cover him up. Ear protection. Eye protection. And keep him comfortable. And they strap him in. And then they bring that up.
Uh-huh.
And once he gets in the chopper, then they bring the penetrator back down, then we both jump on there and we go up.
Wow.
And though that we had a few of those missions.
And you operate as two-man teams?
Yeah, a two-man team. I think I did it one where it was just the one of us that went down. We got him and hooked him up and got him out of there.
Uh-huh. And these are just guys on ships who have medical emergencies?
Yeah. Well, like one guy was, he was on a ship with a bunch of young people.
Mm-hmm.
Merchant Marine guy.
Yeah.
And so he kind of felt left out.
Yeah.
And he would drink a lot and he was taking medication and he fell and hit his head and got a concussion.
Yeah.
And split his head open.
Wow.
So we got him out of there and the helicopter on that one, we flew under the Golden Gate Bridge.
Wow.
Flew underneath it with the chopper because we didn't want to go up in the altitude because, you know, the brain gets swelling.
Yeah.
But we landed Chrissy Field, an old Army field there, and then they took him to the hospital from there.
Now, Jim, how far out at sea are these ships?
This one was probably, he was probably maybe 300 miles, something like that.
Okay.
Yeah, so then we'd get him out of there. And Coast Guard usually will do things from 300 miles in.
Okay.
You know, but their choppers aren't refuelable.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I had two missions that were over 1,000 miles.
Wow.
Yeah, and I had one. They were jump missions. I had three, actually four jump missions, but two of them got canceled when we were out there. And so I went on one. We flew out about a 1,000 miles, a little about 1,100 miles. We flew out, and you fly out in a C-130, and then we parachute in, and we take care of the guy and get him all ready and get him stabilized. And then there's another C-130 coming out with two helicopters, two H-3s.
Yeah.
And so they're flying on their Jolly Greens and they're flying all the way out and they're refueling them on the way out.
Okay.
And they only refuel about every 300 miles.
So you jump straight from a C-130 onto the ship?
No, not onto the ship.
Oh.
You jump out with all your gear and everything and the metal gear. And then we'll drop extra medical gear with a parachute.
Yeah.
And they'll drop it down. So we'll go ahead and we'll jump in. And there's a dinghy in the water. So we land as close as we can to the dinghy.
Okay.
We get into the dinghy and then... they grabbed all the gear that came down the chutes because it has wings on it to float.
Mm-hmm.
So we get all that stuff in there, and then we go over, and then we go up. They drop a ladder out the side of this. Like usually most ships have a door on the side.
Yeah.
They drop a ladder out, and then you climb up the ladder from the dinghy and get in there. And then they hoist the boat with the gear in it up on davits. They bring it up and bring it up on the ship.
Oh, wow.
And then we go up and take care of the pilots or them.
Who's ever hurt?
The victims.
Now, what happens when there's rough sea? That must be really...
Oh, we had one. My first one, I went out with Johnny Stevens, and we didn't know how bad the sea state was until we got out there. And it was 32-foot seas.
Wow.
And those are waves like this. They go like that. They go down, you know. And
yeah.
It was nasty.
Yeah.
And we had no idea. And we ate a bunch of donuts on the way out. Like it was like dummies, you know? So I'm coming down the parachute and I'm looking up the top of the water and I'm not in yet. I'm not in the water yet. And I'm going, oh, this is not going to be fun.
Yeah.
So I get in the water, I dump the canopy and I'm swimming over to the, you know, to the dinghy. I had to wait for the water to come. I had to wait till I came up on a crest where I could see where the dinghy was, hoping he'd be on a crest where I could see him.
Yeah.
And so I'm swimming over to him. I finally get there. That's why you got to be a strong swimmer.
Yeah.
I swam over to him. I see him coming up again. I grab the side of the dinghy. It goes up like this. And I'm looking all the way underneath it.
Oh, my God.
It just came up to the peak and just went down. And when it went down, it just kind of went down like sideways, down, slide down.
Yeah.
I just rolled right into the dinghy. I get in there. And these merchant marines are getting sick.
Yeah.
They're seasick.
Yeah.
They're vomiting. And his vomit's just because the wind.
Yeah.
It's just blowing all over us. And I'm going, damn, this has got to be the worst mission ever.
Oh, you got to be an amazing swimmer to be able to handle 30-foot waves.
Yeah, I've always been a really strong swimmer.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, I love swimming.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was a good swimmer. And
no fear.
Well, you know, what you do is you have fear. I mean, you know, you can die doing it. You jump out with all the stuff, you know. I've got my Lord on my side, you know.
Yeah.
So, but when you jump out like that, you don't think about it. You have to have trust in your equipment.
Yeah.
And you have to put that fear in a little box behind, in a little room.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and the same in combat.
Yeah.
You got to take all that fear and you forget about, like, if you're going to get shot.
Yeah.
You just do your job.
Right.
And if it happens, it happens, and you try to deal with it.
Right.
That's like when I got hit with the RPG and stuff, and I got hit in the face.
Yeah.
You know, you just kind of blow it off until it's over.
Right.
You know, and
wow.
Then you think about it. Unless, of course, you get your leg blown off or an arm blown off or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And we had guys like that caught RPGs, the motor.
Yeah.
It'd blow one guy up and the motor would keep coming. It took one guy's leg off.
Shh.
You know, we had those kind of things. That was Baby Huey. Those things happen.
Yeah.
Tragic. But anyway, so, on that ship, I climbed up the ladder. The dinghy came over. I grabbed the ladder. I climb in. And I'm just puking my guts out. I can just see these. It was a Taiwan ship. And Taiwanese guys, I think, was it the Honda? Yeah, that was the Honda ship. Brings the Honda cars over.
Yeah.
And the kid was a 21-year-old kid. So, but we get in there. I can just see these sailors going, they came to help us.
Who are these crazy guys? They're angels. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
What was wrong with the kid?
He had a ruptured appendix.
Ah.
Oh. And he was blown up like a balloon.
Oh, God. Yeah.
So, but then Johnny Stevens comes up the ladder, and you have to wait to the strong, you have to get the biggest wave to get on that ladder.
Yeah.
He didn't get a big enough wave. And so the boat came back up again, hit him, knocked him off the ladder. He fell into the boat twice. He did that.
Wow.
So finally, he got a big enough wave where he can get up there and get inside. So then we went to the kid and we took care of him. We got him all. The choppers were only about an hour or so out.
Mm-hmm.
So they went ahead and got them ready, got him ready. We put him in a sleeping bag. They dropped the soaked litter. We got him all covered up and everything. We got him up into the chopper. And then we flew to the closest place, which was like 950 miles. It was Coos Bay, Oregon.
Wow.
So we flew there in the chopper, and we had to refuel, but we had to refuel at about 100 feet off the water. You know, you can't go up in altitude.
Yeah.
Because his gut was blown up.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, from the gas.
Yeah.
And if you go up any higher, it's going to be painful. And he was in enough pain.
Yeah.
I was cutting his underwear off him.
Yeah.
And he wanted me to cut his gut.
Yeah.
He wanted me. I could have done a thoracentesis, you know, put a needle in there and got the air out.
Yeah.
But the gut might be pushed up against that. And I didn't want to puncture the gut.
Right.
So, but we got him up there and got him off the chopper. And they took him to the hospital, and apparently he lived okay. He was okay.
Wow.
He was 21-year-old seaman.
Yeah, wow.
And then the other mission I had, that was Commerce's. You know, it was, and our CEO of the base was the commander of the plane flying out. He wanted to fly us out.
Uh-huh.
So, and I was the team leader. Johnny was the team leader on that last mission, and I was the team leader on this mission. And so I had Andy Hale with me, and so we go ahead, fly out there. The seas were nice and calm. It was a easy jump. The guy had a bowel obstruction and an inguinal hernia.
Mm.
And so we jumped in. I was going to jump without the scuba tanks. So the scuba tanks will kill you.
Yeah.
We've had a lot of guys jump with scuba tanks. They need to leave it up to the discretion of the team leader.
Yeah.
Because we jump in the lakes and the ocean all the time without tanks.
Yeah.
Our CEO came back and was watching me put all my gear on. Is Colonel Aguirre was his name. Anyway, he was there, and I'm loading up and I'm getting ready to go in the beautiful seas.
Yeah.
And he goes, "Aren't you supposed to be jumping with scuba tanks?" And I said, "No, it's perfect seas out there. Why take a chance? You can get hurt jumping with those things."
Yeah.
You know, and he goes, "Well, if you're supposed to be jumping with scuba tanks," I'm going, "Sir, I don't tell you how to fly this airplane. Don't tell me how to jump out of it." You know, this is my commander. Yeah. So, and then I looked at him and says, "And furthermore, I can fly your airplane."
Right, right, right.
So I put the tanks on and we both jumped and stuff. And Andy was behind me, and the loadmaster was supposed to watch his static line.
Mm-hmm.
His static line got hung up underneath the tanks.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, so this wouldn't have happened if we didn't have those stupid tanks on.
Yeah.
So I jump out, and I see Andy quite a ways from me. And I see him. He's all twisted.
Yeah.
I turn around and fly my chute over so I can land next to him and make sure he's okay. And some of the guys were taking pictures in there as we were jumping. And in one of the pictures, you could see the static line go under his tank where the guy didn't watch it.
Wow.
So, and that those things, that's dangerous stuff.
Yeah, sure it is. Sure.
I actually cut it out of the picture. The picture's on my Facebook, but I cut the tank out of it so you couldn't see it. I didn't want people to think that, man, look, that's dangerous.
Yeah.
So we got on there, we took care of the guy, and on him, we stayed with him till the ship got to Hawaii. It was a CNH Sugar ship,
mm-hmm.
and we stayed with him to Hawaii. We stabilized him. We got prepped him and got him ready for surgery. And then when we got into the Big Island, Hawaii, the ambulance came. We got him off. And mm-hmm. I got a nice letter from the surgeon. He said that he was prepped. He said the first time he worked for pararescue, and he was amazed on how well he was prepped for surgery and everything else.
Wow.
And really appreciated it.
Wow. So you guys have a lot of medical training as well.
Oh, we have a lot of medical training. Yeah.
Yeah.
The best medics in the military are actually the special forces medics.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they can do amputations. They can do deliver babies and stuff like that. I mean, pararescue guys can deliver babies. That's not a hard thing to do. I mean, babies deliver themselves.
Yeah.
But they, they're highly trained. But the thing with pararescue is they're the most highly trained rescue paramedic.
Yeah.
You remember when they had those Boy Scouts or whatever they were, those Scouts that were locked in a cave in Taiwan or something like that? Yeah, those pararescue guys went in there.
Wow.
They went in with the Thai rescue guys.
Yeah. It's a small unit, right? Pararescue.
It's a very small unit. There's probably less than 12 or 1300 that are living right now.
Yeah. Wow.
You know, because a lot of them, you know, when I went through pararescue, they had three classes that went through and nobody passed.
Really?
Three class, the whole class, everybody failed.
Wow.
And they start off with like 160 guys, and a class might graduate with, you know, anywhere from like 6 to maybe 13 or something.
Jeez. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, they drop out like flies.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is the harassment, underwater harassment, the swimming.
Yeah.
And I meet kids that want to be a PJ, and I tell him, I said, well, you want to swim. And I said, you take a towel, you know, like a bath towel.
Yeah.
And you want to fix it so you can wrap it around your hand and hold on to it like that, so it doesn't come off your hand.
Yeah.
Get two of them, one on each hand.
Yeah.
And you swim, you throw that towel, you bring it up out into the water, throw it over your head and do it with the other towel. You keep doing that. You swim like that.
Wow.
And that'll build your shoulders up.
Yeah.
And the other thing we used to do is get in inner tubes and swim, you know, with the inner tubes.
Uh-huh.
And it builds your shoulders up.
Yeah.
And learn how to swim underwater and hold your breath.
Yeah.
Because you're going to have to swim like 100 yards or something like that, or 100 meters.
Yeah.
100 yards. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
But you have to swim without breaking the surface.
Wow.
And we had a 50-meter pool. So you'd swim all the way under, go all the other end, and come all the way back again, and you come up to the surface. But, you know, you pretty much do that kind of stuff in scuba school, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, yeah, you got to be a really strong swimmer.
Mm-hmm.
When I was going through training with Pearl Rescue, it was in the wintertime. We had four guys in my class. They put me in charge of the class because of my background.
Mm-hmm.
So we had four guys that didn't have their winter jackets for their blues, you know?
Yeah.
So I asked him, I said, what have you got? He goes, all we got is our flight jacket. I'm going, oh no, I can see the writing on the wall. I go get them.
Yeah.
So they put their flight jacket on. So I had my group sitting here. And then I had the other four guys with space and the four guys running behind. And we're all running with our jackets on, and they had their flight jackets on.
Yeah.
So we get to the school and we pull up in front of the school, you know, and because you have to run every place you go when you're PJ.
Yeah.
So we go there and the academy walks up to one of the guys with the flight jacket on. He goes, what are you doing wearing your flight jacket with your blues?
Yeah.
Oh, Sergeant Jones said it was okay, sir.
Yeah.
I'm going, oh, good Lord. I go, why can't you say, oh, was I not supposed to do that?
Right.
Oh, I didn't know.
Right.
Yeah. But no, man, they just threw me under the bus in a heartbeat.
Wow. Wow.
We're still good buddies, though. We're good friends.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the cadre comes over to me and they go, we want to talk to you in the office.
Yeah.
And so I go, oh, I can just see the writing on the wall.
Yeah.
So they dismiss the group and they go to class to learn all their medical and stuff. And I go into the office and they whip out this, you know, what's it called? The blue jacket, not the blue jackets manual. It's a code of military uniform, how you wear your uniform.
Right.
And they're reading this book and they're reading it to me. And they go, drop 1500 pushups. So it took me a day and a half to do 1500 pushups.
Jeez.
I mean, after a while, your arms just don't want to work.
Yeah. 1500. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
I did 500 before lunch, 500 after lunch, and 500 the next morning.
Oh, my
then
God.
Then I'm dragging my knuckles, walking into the room, and I'm just looking at the guys.
Like, you idiots.
And you threw me under the bus, man. I thought you were my buddy.
Yeah, really. Yeah, just play dumb. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, we're still good, buddy. I mean, yeah. PJs are great guys.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, being a PJ has got to be the best job in the world.
Yeah.
It's in the military, that's the best job in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to go out and do some shoot 'em up stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, go into some tier one, like SOG was tier one,
right.
Delta Force, CAG, those tier one guys.
Yeah.
That's what you want to do.
Yeah.
But other than that.
But saving people, yeah.
Great job. All you do is save lives. My gosh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Makes you feel good, too.
I bet.
I was watching this guy,
yeah,
these pararescue guys during that, what's that big hurricane that hit?
Katrina?
Yeah, Katrina.
Yeah.
PJs saved over 4,000 lives, something like that.
Wow.
40,000 lives, 4,000, I don't know.
Yeah.
But they did a lot of life-saving.
Yeah.
Good bunch of guys.
Yeah, fantastic.
And then when I was a pararescueman also, I did, I was one of the medics on Mount St. Helens, Winnipeg.
Wow.
Yeah, the guys up in Oregon were being overworked.
Mm-hmm.
So they asked, you know, if they can get some help. Some guys came from New York. Because New York has a big pararescue unit. Those are the guys that did the perfect storm.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a pretty big unit. We had about 30 guys in our unit.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the National Guard guys, because there's a National Guard unit,
yeah,
a lot of those guys lived out of state and stuff, you know, and they weren't always there.
Yeah.
But I was full-time. I was full-time with them. So I was one of those Rat Fink guys that got double pay. I got National Guard pay, GS9 pay, you know,
mm-hmm,
and then I got active duty pay, and I was active duty over 300 days a year.
Wow.
That's how much I flew.
Wow.
I mean, there was times I did 6 parachute jumps in a day.
Jeez.
Yeah. When they have to repack the chutes.
Yeah.
We don't just disassemble them and repack them, though. We go out and jump them.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
And bring them back, you know.
Wow.
So, but, so yeah, Mount St. Helens was really, I mean, that was quite a devastation. I mean, that was mind blowing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you see all those trees laying on the ground like logs.
Yeah. I've seen those pictures. Yeah.
Yeah. Those trees are only 50 feet from when they were standing.
Wow.
Everything from there to the volcano.
Yeah.
Was all disintegrated.
Wow.
I mean, it was that's a huge forest.
Yeah.
That's a forest.
Yeah.
Trees like 10 feet apart.
Yeah.
Disintegrated.
Disintegrated.
And if you look at those trees laying on the ground,
yeah.
There's no branches. There's no tops.
Yeah.
They were disintegrated.
Yeah.
It's that it just got weak enough where it took the bark off the tree, but it didn't disintegrate the tree.
Right.
And when they hit it, you know, the tree was standing here. It just goes boom like this and then falls over.
Wow.
So they're right there.
Wow.
And I remember, you know, with all the melting of the ice and snow, looking at the river, and you see a lot of those trees coming down the river. You see a lot of elk and deer and stuff in the water being killed.
Yeah.
You know, and we were out there looking for anybody that was alive. But on the first day, they got quite a few of the people out. But just about every one of them were killed.
Yeah.
One of my buddies up there, Dick Carter, he passed away now. He was a fireman. Besides being in the National Guard up there, but he got the, I guess the Moors or something, the family up there, he got all their bodies out.
Mm-hmm.
But they died from inhalation of the gas dust.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the gas, it's all glass.
Yeah.
You know, that's all that ash. But, he got the bodies out, and they were laying with no clothes on. Some of them were in the back end of the pickup. Some were inside a pickup. Some of them were laying on the ground where they tried to get away, and they just choked to death and died.
Mm.
We were up there looking for the sheriff's brother and couldn't find him.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things I thought, there was a D10 caterpillar up there, and it flipped that caterpillar over 6 times.
Wow.
You know, and the one thing that I thought was interesting, there was a couple of derricks there that they were drilling water wells,
mm-hmm.
and the derricks were still standing.
Hmm.
So it was crazy.
Yeah,
it was really a crazy, unbelievable. I mean, it looked like the moon. It looked like the moon. In 1980, I worked with the space shuttle. I was a paramedic for STS-1, 2, and 3.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a mode A contingency paramedic, like, because, you know, the space shuttle is a glider.
Yeah.
And when it comes back down, if it goes too long or too short and they can't pick up the speed or whatever, they're gonna crash. So we would parachute in and take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
So we would train with the astronaut. I went to White Sands and trained with Jim Bajan, Anna Fisher, and Rhea Seddon. They're astronauts.
Mm-hmm.
Trained with them out there, and then when we were actually doing the mission, we were flying, and the shuttle would be coming in, and he goes, "Hey, we're too short. We're going to have to bail out." And the STS-1, 2, and 3 only had 2 seats, so they had ejection seats on the shuttle at that time.
Yeah.
When they went to 3 astronauts, then they disconnected the ejection seats because they didn't want to choose who's going to jump and who's going to stay.
Yeah.
But when we were doing that, we'd be talking to the astronauts.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking like I talked to John Young, and there was Lousmer Fullerton, Engels Truly, and Young and Crippen, Bob Crippen.
So you're following them as they're coming in.
Yeah, what we do is we go out there and we're circling.
Yeah.
As they're coming down in.
Yeah.
And so, but we never had any problems. We did. There was one on STS-3, I think that was Lousmer and Fullerton.
Mm-hmm.
They landed at White Sands, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And but they landed with no problem. They got there and landed, and there was no incidents or problems. So then we just came back.
Mm-hmm.
But on STS-2, that was Engels and Truly, we did a flyby. We got permission to do a flyby, and they got kind of upset. But we flew. We got permission from the tower.
Mm-hmm.
We just came down, did a flyby. I had the door open, and I'm in the door with my camera taking pictures of the shuttle. I'm just sitting in the C-130 with my legs hanging out the door. You
know? Who is this guy? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I had a strap tied on me so I wouldn't fall out, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, being a PJ is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
But we had those hoist missions. You know, I remember one time we had one where we were out there, and then we got a Mayday call coming in. where a salmon fisherman had his boat and he was getting ready to crash into some rocks.
Oh, wow.
And when we flew over there, they used to call me Hawkeye. I had an eye like a hawk. I can pick anything right out of the water. So I went ahead and flying by and I saw the boat and it was on its side.
Oh.
And I could see the little light on the mast.
Yeah.
It would come up out of the water once in a while. And I could see the light. So we flew by and we lit up the area and then we called the Coast Guard and they came on in and got the guys off the side of the boat. They were on the side of the hull.
Uh-huh.
And they were only like about a couple of hundred feet from crashing in the rocks.
Wow.
And they only made that one pass. So they got them all out. They sent us a bunch of salmon and stuff, which was really cool.
That's nice. Yeah.
So, and I had this meat locker downtown.
Yeah.
Because when I used to fly up to Alaska and do rescue up there for plane crashes, I'd fly up to Alaska. I used to get moose meat
mm-hmm.
and salmon and all kinds of stuff, you know, sausage.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd bring it on down and I had this big, big meat locker.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd throw all that stuff in there and for barbecues, you know. I had one time we were training. We would go out in the water in the H3 and we do these like low and slows where you fly, you know, like 10 feet off the water, 15 knots or something. And you just jump out of the chopper into the water.
Mm-hmm.
And we were doing it at night. So then we hold up a chem light and they would come back around and drop the hoist and try to get us up out of the water.
Mm-hmm.
They drop these flares out in the water and they float and they burn.
Mm-hmm.
And it keeps them from getting disoriented.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they're hovering looking at those lights. Because when a chopper's in the water, that rotor wash hits the water and it moves with that chopper. So you can't tell where you are.
Ah,
it looks like you're stationary, but you're not.
Ah, interesting.
So that's why they use those flares at night. I think sometimes they even use them during the day.
Yeah.
But anyway, the chopper comes back around, drops the hoist. We get on the hoist as with Bill Thompson and I, we get on the hoist. We're coming up. We're about halfway between the water and the chopper. Chopper gets vertigo.
Oh no.
Boom. Drops straight down into the water.
Oh my God.
Right on top of us. We got off that penetrator and we just swam as far as we could.
Yeah.
We got up. And we can see the chopper sitting in the water because they float.
Yeah.
But you see them swimming in the water, but they're going to get a ton of water coming in that door.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But anyway, they got up. They just tilt the chopper, get the water out of it, you know, whatever. And they came back around again, and we swam over to it. We got on it, and they zipped us up as fast as they could. We slammed into the bottom of the chopper, about knocked us out.
Wow.
And so we finally get in there, and they stopped doing training hoist missions at night after that.
Yeah.
but they, you know, they still train on it. I'm sure active duty, they got to do it at least once or twice.
Sure, sure.
You don't want to do it cold.
Yeah.
You know, nowhere.
Wow. Well, what a career you've had, man.
Yeah. And when I got out of prayer rescue, I'm very fortunate. I got to do everything I wanted to do. You know, there's a lot more to it than that, you know, 20 years, but, you know, I tell people, if you find out what you want to do, I tell young kids going to school, I said, you find out what you want to do. You want to be an astronaut? I said, call up NASA and ask them what they're looking for.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ask them what they're looking for.
Right.
And then train for it.
Right.
Then when you're done, call them up and say, hey, I'm so-and-so and this is my background.
Yeah.
And I'd like to try out for the astronaut program.
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully you get chosen.
Right. And you went on to become a radiologist. So you had a career.
Yeah. When I left pararescue, I went back to school. I already had a degree in sociology because I was a police officer when I was in reserve special forces.
Mm-hmm.
I was a police officer in San Jose, California.
Uh-huh.
1692, I think, was my badge back then. If anybody wants to check on me. And my name was James Henry Jones back then.
Uh-huh.
So, anyway, I did that, and I didn't like police work. I got out of it, and then I ended up getting a divorce, and that's when I went in the Air Force.
Uh-huh.
But, I did that, and then when I went back to college, and I was getting a degree in anthropology and archaeology, a minor in archaeology.
Mm-hmm.
But I went to San Jose State, which is now University of California, San Jose, I think, now.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was going through it, it was a big poli-sci school, you know, political science. But their anthropology was okay. My wife got a degree in anthropology.
Uh-huh.
Their archaeology is what I really wanted, but it was weak.
Yeah.
There. So anyway, I went through there and I was doing that. And my last year, right for graduation, I decided to switch. And I went and took 2 years of pre-med.
Uh-huh.
And finished my pre-med. I went to three different schools. I went to Golden Gate University,
mm-hmm.
San Francisco University, and then San Jose University there. So I went to those to finish all my pre-med classes. So, I kind of overwhelmed myself with it. And then I went into school to become a chiropractor, and I went to chiropractic college because I didn't want to give people drugs and all that stuff.
Yeah.
For every ache and pain.
Yeah.
Kick myself now.
Yeah.
I was accepted into osteopath school, and I should have went to osteopathic school.
Mm.
But a bunch of my friends said, no, try chiropractic. So I did.
Yeah.
I finished that, and then I went to St. Louis and did a three-year residency in radiology in St. Louis.
Uh-huh.
And you train with all the medical doctors. A lot of people don't realize, but you can be a DO, a DC, or an MD and be a radiologist.
Uh-huh.
But you have to have the anatomy, physiology, pathology, and all that stuff. And they're all trained the same.
Yeah.
It's just the treatments that are different.
Right.
And a DO and a chiropractor treat pretty much the same,
uh-huh.
where the chiropractor is more pinpoint where they're going to treat somebody, and the osteopath might be more gross, like they'll adjust the whole neck, the whole lumbar,
right,
instead of just one segment,
right,
which I think is pretty good. I like that.
Yeah.
And then the osteopaths can go to school for another year and a half or something like that, and then they can work with medical doctors,
mm-hmm.
and they can do, you know, all the other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But our flight surgeon was a DO, and he was on the board in California for, you know, licensing and stuff, and he goes, I get you right into school.
Yeah.
So, but I chose the chiropractic college, and I kicked myself now for it. I also got accepted in the dental school up in Halifax, Nova Scotia,
mm-hmm.
and they would have paid me to go to school up there, but I'd have to work for the 4 years there and then be able to come down here,
mm-hmm.
in the States. So I decided not to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that. Then I went to St. Louis, and when I was in St. Louis, I did my 3 years, finished my residency. I worked in all the hospitals. I think there's like five hospitals we work at. Mellenkrot Institute of Radiology, which is one of the leading radiologist groups in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's nothing but eight floors of nothing but radiology.
Yeah.
And if they have some weird disease like Gorham's and from Europe or something, which is bone vanishing disease.
Wow.
If they get that, they usually go to Mellenkrot, yeah. and they do the studies there.
Yeah.
So it was really a great, great residency.
Yeah.
And so when I came to Tucson, I opened up Diagnostic Imaging and Consultation Service, and then later did Desert Rose Radiology. And then I partnered with a medical doctor out of New Jersey, and we put an MRI, advanced open MRI, in Tucson, and did that. And then he started taking advantage of the money and not paying me like he should. So I told him, I said, look, I want a check right now for $25,000, and I'll finish my contract, $5,000 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote me the check, and I left.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I left there, I started doing a little independent thing. Then I had a guy walk into my office. I was going to sell everything, go buy a boat, and be a bum. And a guy come into my office, and he goes, we want you to work for us. And I'm going, I don't know. I mean, I'm thinking about just quitting this whole thing and just go be a bum. And I asked him, I said, how many cases can you give me? He goes, we'll guarantee you 100 cases a day.
Whoa.
I said, really? What are you going to pay me? He said, we give you $5 a case. I said, what's the other doc getting? Because what they're doing is he's got another doc that's overloaded. He wants me to share.
Yeah.
And he's the one getting paid. Right. So he's getting 15. So tell him I'll do it for $7.50 a case.
Yeah.
And called me up, and he goes, yeah, we'll do it for $7.50 a case.
Okay.
And I never did less than 150 cases. And one day I did 276 cases because everybody loved my reports.
Yeah.
And they were saving them.
Yeah.
They were saving them because they wanted me to read them and not the other radiologist.
Yeah. Wow.
And I just went over the top, and I'm going, this is no fair to the patient. This is no fair to me.
Yeah.
I didn't have a life. I was working 24/7.
Yeah. That's too much.
I just go to bed, and they'd call me up and say, we're sending you 60 cases. I'm like, oh, okay. I'll take a shower, go read them, and go back to bed.
Oh, my God.
I was making a ton of money, but it wasn't worth it.
Yeah.
So I finally just walked away from it and retired.
Uh-huh. What are you doing now, Jim?
I hunt for meteorites.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I go out in the desert and other places, and I just go hunt for meteorites.
Mm-hmm.
And I found quite a few. I'm getting ready to get out of that. I'll always go hunt for them if I'm out in the desert. But I got my metal detectors and stuff. Now I'm just going to write my books.
Okay.
And just do that.
Okay.
You know, I'm figuring, you know, I'm going on 78 years old.
You don't look that at all.
I know. I don't.
Yeah.
I don't have any testosterone. That's why I look young.
Yeah. Yeah. You told me that on the phone.
Yeah. I got this weird medical problem that I was born with called hyperestrogenism.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like all, and this might help with some people with transgender people too.
Yeah.
A lot of, you know, men get their estrogen from their testosterone.
Yeah. It converts, right?
Yeah. With aromatase.
Yeah.
You have a hormone called aromatase, and it causes the testosterone to convert to estrogen.
Yeah.
And you get some men that look like the Paul Bunyans, iron jaws, no fat, or other people that are kind of roly-poly.
Right.
Well, they're either getting less or more estrogen, testosterone converted to estrogen.
Right.
The ones that look more muscular have less and have more testosterone.
Yeah.
The ones that are roly-poly have more estrogen.
Right.
My body doesn't know when to stop converting it.
Ah.
It just keeps converting it.
Wow.
I told them, you know, actually, I had breast tissue and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I told them, I said, I'm not doing it to me. I said, there's something wrong.
Yeah.
And so they tested me and they go, you don't have any testosterone. So they put me on testosterone therapy.
Yeah.
And I'm injecting myself every week with testosterone. And about 3 weeks later, I started feeling pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, I could feel my muscles building and everything. I'm going, hey, this might work. This might be the trick.
Yeah.
Then about 2 weeks later, like 5 weeks into it.
Yeah.
I woke up and I'm going, whoa, what just happened to me? Like that.
Yeah.
I called them up and says, I got to get off this stuff. There's something wrong. I went back in. They tested me again. My estrogen level was 7 to 8 times a female.
Whoa.
All the testosterone I was injecting was converting to estrogen.
Oh, my God.
Plus my own testosterone.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was, whoa.
Yeah.
So now everything is good. I had to take a little estrogen when the testosterone was dropping.
Yeah.
Because it would drop and it would fight like this.
Yeah.
And my face would swell up. I'd get swollen up. If a bee looked at me, I went into anaphylactic shock.
Wow.
I mean, it was horrible. I figured, man, after one little bee barely touched me and I went into anaphylactic shock.
Yeah.
And I went to the hospital. I almost died.
Wow.
They got me to the hospital. They had me on the gurney and my vision was down to like a little thing here.
Yeah.
I couldn't move my arms, my finger. I could barely move my fingers.
Jeez.
I couldn't move anything. And I'm listening. I can hear. My hearing was acute.
Yeah.
I still hear. And I can hear my heartbeat on the monitor.
Yeah.
You know, boom, 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 boom. Oh, I'm going, oh, man, 3.5 years in combat and a bee takes me out. So,
God.
But that doctor,
yeah.
he goes, hit him again. And I can hear the nurse say, you already hit him 4 times with epinephrine.
Yeah.
4 times. He goes, well, we're going to lose him if we don't do something. Just hit him again.
Yeah.
So they hit me fifth time with epinephrine.
Yeah.
And finally, I hear him taking off his gloves. He goes, call me when he comes to.
Wow.
Like that.
Wow.
And so I got up and the doc comes in. You know, I had these big bags under my eyes.
Yeah.
My armpits were in the leg. My groin was all swollen.
Wow.
And he comes in. And he goes, how many bees got you? I go, one.
Yeah.
He just barely touched me.
Yeah.
And he goes, where? And I said, I could feel the needles and pin.
Yeah.
You know, I'm feeling on my down by my ankle.
Yeah.
He goes, right there. He goes, there's nothing there. I go, no, he didn't sting me. He just barely touched me.
Yeah.
He goes, damn, you got something else going on.
Yeah.
So what it was my hormones and my body attacked itself.
Wow.
So one of my buddies who's a world renowned doctor, he said, you're going to have to take either estrogen or testosterone.
Yeah.
And I'm going, oh.
Yeah.
So I was dating this anesthesiologist at the time, and she goes, don't take the testosterone.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it'll give you a heart attack.
It'll just do the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Just, well, plus that now we didn't know that then.
Yeah.
But so I took Premarin and it kicked it up, the estrogen up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I stopped swelling up. I stopped having problems. And I had to do that for a while. And then it came back again after I got to the testosterone thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to do the estrogen thing again. And now I'm off of everything and everything seems to be working really well.
Good.
So I'm happy with that. But it keeps me looking young.
Yeah, yeah. Very young. Yeah, yeah. It's got a benefit.
Yeah. And I feel young and I act young.
Yeah.
But I have a lot of aches and pains, you know, from all the injuries. You know, I said,
I'm sure.
Life is good. I can't complain.
Good for you, man.
I'm getting ready to. I've been working on my house here in Bisbee for 4 years. This is my catch-all room here. But so those are all my meteorites and boxes back there. I'm getting rid of a bunch of those.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to sell the place and I'm going to go move down by the airport and buy myself another airplane and just be a bum.
Good. Good for you.
I love Bisbee.
Yeah.
Bisbee's a real liberal town, but
I heard it's a nice town. Yeah.
Oh, it's a great town. It's one of the best towns in Arizona.
Yeah.
Everybody's so friendly. I go to this place called Kafka Coffee and it's a great coffee shop. I mean, the guy acts like a real asshole in there, but he's just one of those guys, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He's, you know, I go, hey, Brucey, how you doing today?
Fuck you.
and his girlfriend, his wife, you know, I guess, yeah. You know, she's just a sweetheart, just a real sweetheart.
Yeah.
So, but I just love it there. And all my friends come in there and we all talk. And then I leave and come up here.
Well, Jim, thank you so much. This is fantastic. What a life you've had, you know, just incredible service to our country and to other people. And
well, I appreciate that.
Yeah, really a remarkable man, really remarkable man.
Well, it's, you know, to me, it's just been fun. I've enjoyed it.
Despite all that he's accomplished so far, Jim's energy hasn't diminished, nor has his thirst for knowledge and adventure and lust for life. Currently, he hunts, sells, and collects meteorites. We thank him for his service in the Navy, Air Force, and Army Special Forces, and for being one of the elite group of remarkable individuals who volunteered for MACV SOG, which had a casualty rate that exceeded 100%, the highest sustained American loss rate since the Civil War. And it boasts the highest kill ratio in U.S. military history, topping out at an incredible 158-1 in 1970 and making them the stuff of legend. It's my great, great honor to name the extraordinary Jim H. Shorten Jones, a.k.a. Wild Carrot, as today's Hero Behind the Headlines.
Heroes Behind Headlines. Executive producer Ralph Pizzullo. Produced and engineered by Mike Dawson. Music provided by Extreme Music. For exclusive content, please join our Patreon group at patreon.com/heroesbehindheadlines.